Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sue Fraser, representing my colleagues on the Press Club Committee. President Don Riddell is unable to be with us here today, but would you please welcome in his place our most precious committee member, Rex Jory.
Precious. He called me precious. I heard that. Good afternoon. Rex Jory is my name. I'm a member of the Press Club Committee. It's my duty today, or my pleasure today, to welcome you all here. I see many regular faces and some new ones, particularly to those who haven't been here before. Welcome to your first Press Club lunch. I'd like to acknowledge particularly S.A. Water, who were kind enough to invite me and as their guest, and I had to turn them down because of my higher duties. Do enjoy your day. The Honourable Peter Lewis, the Speaker of the House of Assembly, welcome, Peter. And to all of you, a big welcome. The arrangements today are very simple. They have been clouded, however, by the fact that we don't actually have a guest speaker in the building at the moment. But assuming our organisational capacities do come together, we'll serve the main course. At about 1 o'clock, we'll call on the Honourable Alexander Downer to address the lunch. And it is traditional that the speaker, whoever it might be, take questions afterwards, and that the working media, and in the case of the Advertiser, that's sometimes dubious, but I won't go there. The working media take the first questions, but if they peter out because of one reason or another, it's often alcohol, then anyone is invited to speak from the floor. I'd urge you, please, to, if that's the case, to please keep your questions short, and I'm sure that Mr. Downer will oblige. So please enjoy your lunch. On the table you'll see some raffle tickets. We are financially desperate. We have an annual general meeting next week, and we do need your help. So, wasn't I not there? But we'd like to kick off the year in good spirits. Thank you all very much, and as I speak, Mr. Downer arrives. Thank you, and do enjoy yourselves.
I'd just like to wait until our guest speaker is seated. Ladies and gentlemen, if I could just have your attention again for a moment. Thank you. The Press Club acknowledges corporate support of Telstra, and we thank its representatives from Telstra for their ongoing support. The Press Club has formed an alliance with the University of South Australia's Experience Bank. The Experience Bank is the university's online careers centre where employers look to find their professionals of tomorrow. Please have a look at their website. Our wine sponsor today is Orlando Wyndham, and we're serving 2001 Jacobs Creek Reserve Riesling and 1999 Jacobs Creek Reserve Shiraz, and we also thank SA Brewing for the beer. Now, if you'd like to be included on our mailing list for lunches in 2003, please leave us your business card when you leave today out at the front desk. We're also building a database of email addresses, and if we don't have your email address, we would like it, so leave that out the front as well. Now, as Rex said, we're financially desperate, so there's a raffle on our table. They're $2 each, or three for $5, and you could win, from Telstra, the audio line cordless telephone with digital answering system and call display, and we'd all like that, I can tell you. If you haven't been to the Rock Lobster Cafe in Googer Street for a while, here's your chance. You could win a $50 voucher to enjoy some delicious seafood, thanks to Walter Rogers. He's holding it up here right in front. And Walter also has a $50 voucher from Ragoni's Bistro. There's another one in Lee Street. It's a great place to go and enjoy some Italian food, traditional or modern. We also have two cartons of SA Brewing beer, Southwark Premium and Hahn Light. Finally, as a courtesy to our guest speaker today, if you have a mobile phone with you, would you please now turn it off? We'll be back soon. Thank you.
Gentlemen, can I have your attention just briefly, please? I'm impressed with the amount of conversation that's going on out there, but I'm going to interrupt. It's my pleasure this afternoon to introduce, albeit briefly, our guest speaker, the Foreign Minister, the Honourable Alexander Downer. I read this week that the amount of technological knowledge available today, 2002, is 1% of the technological knowledge which is going to be available in 50 years. We're really only at the dawn of the IT explosion. We are moving into a new world which has really shrunk the globe. When once in Australia we were happy to hear the chimes of Big Ben on the ABC, or look at a map of the world and see that it was comfortably coloured in red, we are now part of that world that we were so isolated from even 30 years ago. Those days have gone. You can now get on the internet and look up the street directory of almost any city in the world. You can probably find the address on the electoral roll of almost any person in any city, certainly in the Western world. So information's with us, and as it comes along, the world gets smaller. And of course, the portfolio of foreign affairs becomes enormously important in that shrinking world. We have world tensions which now affect us in Iraq, in Pakistan, India, in Timor, and other parts of the world. And we are now part of that world. We can't any longer step back from it. Alexander Downer has the responsibility of our foreign policy and our voice in that world. Alexander was just running through in a sentence his career, and he mentioned working in foreign affairs, and at each point he said, and that was exciting. Then he became a junior shadow minister, and that was exciting. And then he became a minister, and that was exciting. He recalls, in fact, that he became leader of the opposition, and that was very exciting. And then that position was taken away from him, he said, and that was also exciting. But today, Alexander Downer is one of the senior voices in the federal government, and it's important for us because he's a South Australian. But politics is a curious beast, you'd have to admit that. We look back over the period of Don Dunstan, and there are many people that say, ah, Don Dunstan, he was the fellow that wore the shorts into Parliament. Or Malcolm Fraser, he was the fellow who didn't wear trousers in Memphis. And I hate to admit it, or to say it, Alexander, but you will always be remembered as the man in a charity shop, in the best of intentions, who showed a fine ankle in fishnet stockings. I've checked out the minister's ankle today. You can check them out for yourselves. Alexander Downer.
Well, thanks very much, Rex, and members of the South Australian Press Club, and ladies and gentlemen. I guess I have a feeling, having listened to that introduction, that I ought to get my own back against Rex, and I've been reflecting on this, but I enjoy reading his columns every day, and I don't know whether his subsequent retaliation in one of his columns would make the investment that I could make now worthwhile. So I'll just say that it's a pleasure to be at the South Australian Press Club, clearly here in my hometown of Adelaide, which I don't spend enough time in, obviously, as the Foreign Minister, but I always enjoy coming back to. And I noticed, talking of Rex Jury, that this morning in the Advertiser, his column stridently defends South Australia, and good luck to him. I'd like to feel that that article in the Sydney Morning Herald was just a tongue-in-cheek article, but I had a bit of a sense looking at it myself. Kind of hard to read because there's a small version of it in the advertiser by Rex's column. It's kind of hard to discern what it says, but I had a feeling that there might be a lot of people in Sydney who'd hold that view. And as Rex points out, that's completely unacceptable. For me, in any case, as I said, I travel to many of the great cities of the world. I go to many of the troubled countries of the world. And I say this very sincerely, whenever the plane comes down to land at Adelaide Airport, and particularly when I go in the car through the tunnels, the Hyson tunnels, I feel I've truly returned to the ultimate of civilization. And I think all of us who are South Australians can be tremendously proud of Adelaide. We can be tremendously proud of the Adelaide Hills. And we're a very critical people, I think, Australians generally, very self-critical. But when you do travel around the world and you come back here, you just do realise, to use a rather tired old cliche, how really lucky you are. But let me make one other point. As I travel in and out of Adelaide so often, needless to say, I use the airport a great deal. And as you all undoubtedly know, it's the most old-fashioned, dysfunctional and shabby capital city airport in Australia. It doesn't have air bridges in its domestic terminal. And, well, look, it doesn't worry me too much, excepting when you walk out there to the plane and back in the rain, or if there's a strong north wind and dust is blowing across the tarmac. But I do think that the quality of our airport is the one thing that does do some damage to the image of our state and the image of our city. You know, business leaders who are thinking of investing here are immediately confronted with this Hicksville-style airport, but a great city beyond it. Now, they'll get to the great city beyond it, and I don't think in the end you could ever argue that the airport itself is going to affect their investment decisions, but I do think that it's important that the welcome people receive is a warm welcome. When I encourage foreign dignitaries to meet me here in Adelaide, and I get a lot of them to come here rather than to go to Canberra, I do think it would be better if I was able to greet them at a slightly more modern airport. And the point is that we are a capital city, and our airport is, in terms of use, a sizeable airport. Almost 4.5 million passengers a year go through our airport, and there are about 75,000 aircraft movements every year. Now, that's almost double the traffic at the important tourist airports such as Cairns, and it's a similar quantity volume as you would get in Perth. There are more passengers and there are fewer movements in Adelaide. But somehow Perth and Cairns have managed to get modern, efficient airports, and we haven't. Now, I know that successive state governments have grappled with this issue and that the collapse of ANZET last year did complicate a proposal we thought was coming to fruition. But let me say that, bearing in mind that Adelaide Airport Limited are now having discussions with Virgin and with Qantas about plans to rebuild the airport, I think it is very important that this new airport is completed by the end of 2004, and that the airlines, as well as Adelaide Airport Limited, understand that they have very serious obligations to the city they serve to ensure we have an adequate airport here, consistent with the status of South Australia and the status of the city of Adelaide. I bumped into Premier Ran, as I often do, this time in Shanghai, when we were both there for the Australia Week at the Shanghai International Festival. I know he very much shares this view. And look, I know he has been busy lately building a bigger cabinet, but I think his construction project on the airport should be a higher priority. Anyway, I wanted to talk to you today beyond the airport about the broader international environment and Australia's place in that environment and the issues that really confront us. I think you know only too well the sense of concern, the sombre mood that there is in Australia today about terrorism and the dangers and the risks of terrorism to Australians. And that was, of course, brought home to us very dramatically on October the 12th with the bombings in Bali. And South Australians tragically were killed at that time, as well as a total of, we think, 86 or possibly 87 Australians. 86 have been confirmed dead, and there is what my department describes as serious concern about one other Australian. We're not quite sure what could have happened to that person who was in Bali at that time. Our point here is that as a government, we have to do everything we can to try to protect Australia from terrorism on the one hand, but on the other hand, to make a contribution to ensuring that the scourge of terrorism is eliminated from the world. And that, of course, is a massive challenge. There has been all sorts of terrorism over the years. There's been, in recent times, the IRA, ETA in Spain, which is the Basque nationalist terrorist group, which conducts terrorist bombings against civilian targets in Spain from time to time, still exists. There are the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka, and I could give you a list of other smaller terrorist organisations than them. What we're dealing with, though, today, more broadly, is a different kind of terrorism, a transboundary terrorism, a terrorism that stretches around the world, which is coordinated, which is sophisticated, and which is well-funded, and that is the Islamic extremist terrorism encapsulated in organisations like Al-Qaeda, Jamaat Islamiya in Southeast Asia, Abu Bakr Bashir being a spiritual leader of that organisations in the Philippines like Abu Sayyaf, and in Malaysia like KMM, and there are many others. The first thing I'd say about this kind of terrorism is that in recent years we have learned a great deal more about it. And by learning more about it, our level of concern has risen very substantially. And it's not just the terrorist attacks that we've seen, Bali more recently, of course, September the 11th last year, New York, Washington and Pennsylvania. It's the information we have gradually accumulated, I think one would say especially since September the 11th last year, about the extent of the networks, the number of people involved, and the sophistication of these networks, which has caused us particular concern and helps us to understand the depth of the challenge that lies ahead of us in trying to overcome this Islamic fundamentalist terrorism. The second thing I'd say about it is that when you're confronted with a political challenge, be it, you know, some sort of a local political challenge or a global security challenge of this kind, it is very important to know your enemy, and it is very important to understand what the objectives of your enemy really are. In this case, I think there is scant understanding in Western countries, including in our own country, about the objectives of these Islamic terrorist organisations. We're particularly focused on the acts of terror that have been committed against, in the first place, us as Australians, and in the second place, high-profile targets such as the World Trade Center. So we may think that the real objective of these terrorist organisations is just to kill or damage Westerners. Of course, they have more sophisticated objectives than just that. That is a means to an end. That isn't their ultimate objective. I think it is unlikely in the extreme that any of these people from Osama bin Laden down, or maybe one should say from Osama bin Laden up, at least in moral terms, that any of these people would ever think that they could convert the United States of America or the United Kingdom or Australia or the European Union into Islamic fundamentalist Taliban-style states. I mean, clearly they would understand that is beyond the bounds of possibility. Their objective is to turn Islamic countries into Islamic fundamentalist Taliban-style states. What they want to do is have a Taliban-style regime in Indonesia, in Malaysia, in the southern Philippines, in southern Thailand and Brunei, in Southeast Asia, and in the Arabian Peninsula, in Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Oman, Qatar, and so on. That's what they want to do. They want to establish fundamentalist Taliban-style Islamic regimes, theocracies in these states, so that the Islamic world can, as they would put it, return to its true roots. That means, if you stop and think about it, that their ultimate objective is the overthrow of the status quo governments in those countries, of what we might call, by way of shorthand, moderate secular Islamic governments, the governments such as President Megawati's government in Indonesia, or King Fahd's government in Saudi Arabia, I suppose more fundamentalist, much more fundamentalist than the government of Indonesia. But nevertheless, a government which has allowed the adoption of a good deal of modernity, new technology into Saudi Arabian society. Their objection to the West, the terrorists' objection to the West, is that they perceive that the West not only props up these societies and spreads its values and its technology, and through its technology still more its values into these societies, but that the governments, as they see it, of those societies are supported fundamentally by the West, by the United States and the allies, be they cultural allies or they be military allies of the United States. And so what they want to do is drive out of these countries Western influence and then in turn overthrow the governments of those countries and establish Taliban-style regimes. And I think it is very important for us in Australia to understand that, to understand what their objectives are. Because that brings me to the third point I'd make about this, and that is, well, how do you counter this type of movement? First of all, let me say it's very difficult to do. We should have no illusions about that. It is going to take us years to overcome this problem of Islamic extremist transnational terrorism. And don't believe people who say to you that this is a 6-month or a 1-year project, or politicians who pretend that they can fix the problem between now and their next election, wherever they may be and whenever it is. I'm sure none in Australia have said that, but or in America, but you might find that here and there. It's not possible. This will take years to deal with. And we have to understand that having lived through the, for my age group, I look around the room, I'm not the youngest person here, so all of those of you who are younger than me definitely just had this experience. For my age group, we have had the Cold War for most of our lives until 1991. And then we had a sense that those great confrontations, the anxiety that the Cold War brought with it, were past. I think we have to understand that we are now into a new and dangerous era where we have this confrontation between those who support what we might broadly describe as our civilization, and I don't mean Western civilization, I include moderate Islamic civilization, and those who don't tolerate anything but their own views, and that is the Islamic extremist, fundamentalist terrorists. And we have to understand this is going to be tough. There are several things we have to do to counter it. First of all, yes, there is a role for the military, but the role for the military is actually rather a limited role. The example of Afghanistan is the best example I can find, where under the Taliban you had the state, the government of the country, as a supporter of these people and of these terrorist activities. Indeed, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were mixed in with each other as a very similar, in some cases the same organisation. There were Al-Qaeda military units that fought with the Taliban army. And Afghanistan, as a result of that, was not only a political base for Al-Qaeda and for the terrorist movement, but not only the place where they coordinated, but it was the place where they trained, it was the place where they from which they raised finance, it was the place where they did their logistics work and so on. There was a clear, I think, appropriate and justifiable case for launching military action against the Taliban in Afghanistan and to overthrow that government and in the end for it to be replaced by the government of President Karzai. And that was a military campaign. There's mopping up still being done, some difficulties in Afghanistan, but the Taliban al-Qaeda regime has been overthrown and the capacity of terrorists to operate out of Afghanistan is now severely limited. It's more or less impossible for them to do anything except what they are doing in Afghanistan, and that's running and hiding, and but not training, not planning, not doing all that sort of work. Beyond that, though, we have to fight terrorism through different means. Because governments around the world do not support terrorism. I mean, that is a great bond of unity we have. Even when there are differences of view about how to do it, it is a great bond of unity that we have amongst most of the governments of the world. Indeed, this war against terrorism, or this campaign against terrorism, has brought together many governments that in the past had great differences, like China and the United States. So we all agree that it needs to be defeated. And obviously cooperation between us is going to be central to defeating terrorism. We need to understand the importance of intelligence, putting resources, money, men and women into intelligence organizations who are well-trained, who have sophisticated capabilities, so that intelligence agencies, not just ours, and we are increasing the funding and training of people in our intelligence agencies, but in other countries such as Indonesia and many other parts of the world, that more effort needs to be made in the area of intelligence to track down these people, to understand what they're doing, so that action can be taken against them. And I don't frankly think we've still got intelligence agencies in many parts of the world up to the mark. We have in this country, I mean, we're continuing to build our intelligence capability here, and we've started to invest fairly heavily in it, but we do need to understand there are other parts of the world where more needs to be done to help with the development of their intelligence agencies. Secondly, issues that have been controversial in the past here in Australia, like border control, are very important. The quality of immigration services in different countries, the quality of their customs services, very important issues in terms of ensuring terrorists and terrorist organisations can't move freely between countries and can't, in particular, move their materiel between countries. The third point I'd make is the financing of terrorism. If we can do more to stop the financing of terrorism, that would, of course, be an important step forward as well. They need money to buy arms, weapons and so on. And we've, of course, taken steps. There are significant measures that have been put in place to address that, but not sufficient. We've taken significant steps, but we still haven't taken sufficient steps as an international community. I think probably here in Australia we have that situation in good shape, but I don't think that is true in many parts of the world, particularly in the developing world. The final point I'd make, and there are many other things one could say about this, but the final point I'd make about countering terrorism, of course, is that we have to stop the weapons of war falling into their hands. And that means all kinds of weapons, from bomb-making equipment through to weapons of mass destruction. And for us as a government, we've often made the point that so-called weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, chemical, biological weapons falling into the hands of terrorists would have indescribable consequences for the world. It's bad enough that these types of weapons should fall into the hands of governments which are in themselves possibly weak or conceivably, as is the case with Iraq, malintentioned. Governments which already have a record of using these types of weapons, governments that already have horrific records in terms of their relationships with their neighbours, invading their neighbours and the like, and of course using weapons of mass destruction, as in chemical weapons, against their neighbours. Our point here is that the international community has to show real strength and real resolve to try to control the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, of nuclear, chemical and biological weapons. I think it's got to be a bigger issue than it already is for the international community. We have a strong record as a country in addressing these issues. Once we signed and ratified the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, in the time, I think, from recollection of the Gorton government, after a certain amount of debate here in Australia as to whether we should or whether we shouldn't, we've been very active as a country in addressing these issues of weapons of mass destruction proliferation. My predecessor, well, you know, and I know in Australian politics we shouldn't ever pay any tribute to anybody from another party, but my predecessor, Gareth Evans, did a very good job in contributing to the formation of what's called the Chemical Weapons Convention, designed to stop the proliferation of chemical weapons. And since I put in a good word for him, I might put in a good word for his successor, that is me, that I took to the United Nations the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the CTBT, in 1996, 6 or so months after I became the minister, and got it endorsed by the United Nations General Assembly. So we put in, Australia put in place that particular piece of international law designed to help stop the proliferation of, in that case, nuclear weapons. So we have been stalwart over many years, really since the late 1960s, in trying to address this issue of the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. And we just have to keep at it. And, you know, we have to understand in the case of Iraq, and hopefully Iraq will be resolved peacefully through the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1441. We don't know whether it will be or not, but hopefully it can be. But the point is, what we have to achieve in the case of Iraq is the elimination of its weapons of mass destruction capability. And you think what would happen in 5 or 10 years' time if we did nothing about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and Iraq built up a massive arsenal of nuclear, chemical and biological weapons, what sort of awesome power it would have in the Middle East, such a sensitive part of the world. What would the implications of that be for the world? A government like the government of Saddam Hussein, having that sort of awesome power, power that he's already demonstrated he's prepared to use, and by which time, of course, it would be too difficult to do very much about it. So let us hope that Saddam Hussein has learnt. Let us hope he has learnt that the United States and the international community have the resolve to ensure these weapons of mass destruction in Iraq are eliminated. And hopefully if he's learnt that, if he's learnt that the resolve is there, he'll work with the United Nations, with UNMAVIC and the IAEA, and give up any weapons of mass destruction capability he has. So, ladies and gentlemen, I think we live in a somber time internationally. I think it is a very difficult and a rather dangerous international environment. And all I can say to you is that the federal government is working as hard as it can to provide for the security of the Australian people, which is our first and most important responsibility as a government. And it is difficult to do. We can't give guarantees, because terrorists, they work stealthily by definition. We can't guarantee, as we were unable to do in the case of Bali, that our intelligence services will detect their plans, what they're proposing to do. But I can give you a guarantee that we'll do everything we possibly can to try to ensure that Australia, Australians as well as Australia itself, Australians are as secure as is humanly possible in this difficult environment. But we do have to understand that this war against terrorism, this campaign against terrorism, must be pursued. It has to be done internationally. We can't just leave it to the United States or somebody else to do it. We all have to be involved in trying to defeat this terrorism to provide for a much more secure world in the future. Thank you very much.
I'm not going to let the Minister escape without some questions. What I would class that as an excellent address. Two points stick in my mind. The domestic issue of our airport, which many of us, in fact, almost everyone in this room would agree with. But the second was the chilling phrase that we have a scant understanding in Australia of how serious the issue of terrorism is. I would now call on members of the media who will be under the very firm control of Madam Fraser to question the Minister on any issue they might want to raise.
Mr. Banner, Miles came from the Advertiser. If you said that the aim of organisations like JI is to undermine the regimes within these countries in Southeast Asia, and their first aim is to force out Western interests, why on earth then would you threaten the sovereignty of these countries and the existing regimes by threatening them with preemptive strikes?
Well, you wouldn't. And we haven't. So since I thought somebody had asked me a question about that, I thought what I'd do is bring along the Prime Minister's words so you can judge for yourself how hostile and aggressive his words really were. And in answer to a question from Laurie Oakes, he said this: "It stands to reason that if you believe that somebody was going to launch an attack against your country, either of a conventional kind or a terrorist kind, and you had the capacity to stop it, and there was no alternative other than to use that capacity, then of course you'd have to use it." Now, this isn't articulating some dramatic new doctrine of preemptive strikes. I think you need to understand the context of these sorts of remarks, as I was explaining to the Southeast Asian ambassadors this week. The context of these remarks is that the countries of Southeast Asia are opposed to, not supporting, terrorist organisations. And nobody is suggesting they do support terrorist organisations, and no one's ever said that they are proposing to. As Mr. Howard said, the situation hasn't arisen. The reason it hasn't arisen is that the governments of Southeast Asia support the war against terrorism and the campaign against terrorism. And to a greater and lesser extent, we appreciate the work that they've been doing. And the only point the Prime Minister is making here is that he is the Prime Minister of our country, has an obligation to provide for the security of our people. I mean, that is just an incontestable proposition. So I think, look, as time goes on, when the Prime Minister made a similar remark to this in June of this year, nobody said anything. When he made a remark 5 days ago, there was, some reporting, not much reporting, but some reporting here in Australia, but I think some very extravagant media reporting in parts of Southeast Asia about what the Prime Minister has said. But let me quote one of the ambassadors who I spoke to a couple of nights ago, one of the Southeast Asian ambassadors, and I was saying to them that at the end of the day, we are happy with the cooperation that we've been getting from Southeast Asian governments, and of course, there'll be times when we have differences of view, as they have differences of view with each other. When they do, that's not reported here. That's understandable, I suppose. But we all have differences of view from time to time, but we mustn't let bickering get in the way with a united campaign to deal with the issue of terrorism. And at the end of the discussion, one of the ambassadors made this, one of the heads of mission made this point, if you like, back to me on behalf of all of the ambassadors there, that we all understand that if we're going to bicker amongst each other, then that plays into the hands of the terrorists. The more we're divided, the less effective we're going to be. The more we're united, the more effective we're going to be. So I just see this as a passing shower. And I think overall the level of cooperation between Australia and Southeast Asians pre- and post-Bali has been simply outstanding. It doesn't make a big story in the Advertiser, I suppose. I mean, I would question whether the Advertiser even mentioned it when in August I was in Kuala Lumpur and signed the Memorandum of Understanding on Counter-Terrorism with the Malaysian government, or when in February it would have been mentioned in the Advertiser. The Prime Minister signed the MOU on Counter-Terrorism with Indonesia, or when I was in Thailand it wouldn't have been mentioned, July, August, that sort of time, I signed a Memorandum of Understanding on Counter-Terrorism with Thailand. But the cooperation is very good and it will continue.
Well, to quote another media outlet, the Straits Times in Singapore, Mr. Downer, there seems to me that the bickering is continuing because there are wildly different accounts of the meeting you had with the 10 ASEAN foreign representatives yesterday. You said, and I quote, or I hope I quote, "We had a very constructive meeting and they're all perfectly happy." The Philippine president, the Malaysian foreign minister seems to disagree, though. He says that in relation to Mr. Howard's comments, "If we were the only ones who misunderstood, we can forgive. But could the statement be misunderstood by 10 countries?" Philippine vice president said, "I say it as an act of arrogance that disregards the right of nations and prejudices our friendly ties." That's of your comments at the meeting. And
no, it's again, not actually, again, no, to be fair, that
again
is
of your comments
comment about my comments at the meeting.
Again,
he
of
wasn't
your comments
referring to the meeting.
Again, of your comments, the Philippine Foreign Affairs Undersecretary said that's an absurd and insensitive reaction. You won't apologise for threatening preemptive attacks on Southeast Asian countries. Will you apologise for grossly misrepresenting your colleagues, your foreign representatives?
Well, I think that's a disgraceful thing to say. I think you should apologise for putting a question like that in that sort of a language, because yes, you're reading a few things out and putting your own words around them, and in a most monstrous distortion, from you of the government's position. Now, first of all, I'm not going to respond to every comment that everybody makes publicly. There are all sorts of reasons why people make comments publicly, and I'm not getting into that, and I'll tell you something. It's not in Australia's national interest that we get into a continuing argument with people about who said what, when and why, and respond to every critical remark that's made of us. We're bigger than that, and we won't do that. The second thing is, you say that the meeting, that I had claimed the meeting was a very constructive meeting, and then you quote a Malaysian foreign minister who'd said something else. The meeting was a very constructive meeting. There were no harsh words said at all at that meeting. And including with the Malaysian High Commissioner, it was a very constructive and a very positive meeting, and I think that they very much appreciated the initiative of mine to meet with them. I'm not getting into an argument with the Malaysian media or Malaysian politicians. As I've always said, the wisest course we can follow as a country when we get a lot of extravagant criticism from Malaysia is to let the ball fly through to the keeper. Now, I know the wicket keeper's been a bit busy in recent times, but nevertheless, we'll just keep him busy. And in relation to, you know, the last point you make, this is the problem we have, that, you're quoting the Straits Times. Why don't you go and work for the Straits Times if it's so great? But I'm not getting into debate with you. I'm making a point to you. That at the end of the day, I quoted the Prime Minister's words. The Prime Minister is not suggesting for one minute that Australia is going to bomb our neighbours or send in the SAS to attack our neighbours. And people in this country know that, and you know that. And the more our own you raise your eyebrows as though you may not know it. Well, let me assure you, this government has no plans to bomb our neighbours or to send the SAS into neighbouring countries to do over the, you know, whichever country it might be in Southeast Asia, nor has the Prime Minister ever said that. And I think the problem here is the reinterpretation of the Prime Minister's words, the overinterpretation, the elaborate exaggerations, the words like crisis and so on emerging. Somebody says, I've never called anybody in the, I have in my whole of my life, I have to confess this, but in the context of this this debate, I've never referred to anybody being arrogant or whatever it may be. It's not the language I've used. Others have used those words, but not the Australian government. And I just think it's better that we understand what we're saying, we explain what we're saying, and as I said after the meeting the other day with the ASEAN ambassadors, the Southeast Asian ambassadors, look, I know only too well that there'll be, you know, one or two more comments made, but I think this issue will fairly quickly die down, so I don't think the advertiser should try to whip it up again.
Mr. Dan and Jennifer Ashcroft from Channel 9, you've been widely quoted as saying that the comments about preemptive strikes against terrorists were for domestic consumption, yet the government's also said that Australians have the right to be protected. Does this send out a mixed message?
No, I haven't been widely quoted as saying that. There was a report in the Age yesterday based on something somebody else apparently said to somebody at the Age, that I said that at the meeting, and as I explained in the Parliament yesterday, I didn't say that at the meeting at all. Indeed, I made the point that in discussing this issue with a local audience, with an Australian audience, it was important that the Prime Minister should explain Australia's position.
Do you concede that our relationship with our Asian neighbours has been at all damaged by this?
Look, I think fundamentally, of course not. Because fundamentally, this is a relationship which is based on mutual interest, and I think Australians should, particularly commentators, should understand this perspective. It's in the interest of Southeast Asian nations that the resources of Australia, which are so substantial, work with their resources to help defeat terrorism. At the same time, it's in the interests of Australia, that the resources of the Southeast Asian nations are brought to bear to deal with terrorism. That's why this point about the memoranda of understanding that I made earlier, this point about the memoranda of understanding on counter-terrorism with a number of countries is so important. And all I can say to you is that we have had the most outstanding cooperation with the Indonesians in the post-Bali environment, probably better cooperation than this country has ever had on any single issue with Indonesia since 1949, when the Dutch left Indonesia. And we are immensely appreciative of the cooperation and the hand of friendship that Indonesia has extended in that post-Bali environment. And look, this is just one of those things that blows up from time to time in international relations. And as I said in answer to the sort of provocation of the previous question, there's nothing to be gained for Australia in me getting into equally with some of the criticism there have been from overseas, equally extravagant rhetoric. I mean, I've spoken with the ambassadors. I think we did have a very friendly and a very constructive meeting, a very good meeting. And as a result of that, and I haven't actually seen any criticism in any of the cable traffic of that meeting from anybody, you couldn't. It was an extremely productive and constructive and well-judged meeting. And I think we all understand, we all understand only too well the significance of cooperation across the region.
Just turning quickly to Iraq, Washington says that it has evidence which it has not passed on to the UN, but it believes that weapon inspectors should be taking a more aggressive approach. Do you agree with that?
Sorry, can you just repeat that?
The...
I rest my case, by the way, having read that. It's a complete distortion, your question, because I've read that already. It's not criticising the meeting at all.
Washington says it has information that weapons inspectors should be taking a more aggressive approach in Iraq. Do you have evidence that they should be doing that, and do you agree with that?
Well, I think we'll just have to wait and see how the inspections process goes. The inspections have only been underway for a very short period of time, and as the as the Secretary General of the United Nations said just the other day, the critical point here is that there is a very long way to go in the inspections process. And, the first week went okay, but the fact is, it's all it is. It's only the first week. And the weapons inspectors have a vast job ahead of them. So I just think it's too early to make hard and fast judgments.
Okay, and just finally, in terms of you saying that we're living in a new and dangerous world, as a fellow South Australian, do you think we have anything to worry about in terms of being a terrorist target?
Well, I just think, you know, we don't have any, as you'd be well aware, any specific information in relation to South Australia. But I would just make the broader point, I'd just make the broader point to you that across Australia we do have to exercise a degree of appropriate caution. The government gave a warning now a couple of weeks ago that we need to be particularly cautious over the next couple of months. We have generalised information. We don't have specific information. But certainly during the Christmas New Year period, people just need to be a little more cautious than they might naturally have been otherwise. So we think we have obligations to pass on this type of information to the Australian people. We think it would be wrong to keep that type of information secret from people. But as the Prime Minister has explained, we don't want to overstate these things. We don't want to exaggerate. We don't want to cause a sense of panic, but we don't want to cause a sense of complacency. That's a hard balance to find.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, or very fortunately, become very close to the families of the three South Australian victims of the Bali bombings. I've had to watch them go through the aftermath of losing their loved ones, and during the time in Bali, be with them when they were told by consular officials that they were overstretched, couldn't cope, by federal police that they couldn't answer questions, and so on and so on and so on. I don't know really where to start. It's been a complete and absolute shambles. And repeated statements by you, your representatives, that everything was not a shambles and that you reacted with speed and efficiency are blatantly untrue. And at the end of the day, it will come out. But I don't want to be provocative because, obviously, that elicits a rather strong response from you. I just want to know, on September 20, a travel advisory was issued by the Australian government for people planning to travel to Indonesia from Australia. On October 3rd, the Jakarta Embassy issued a special bulletin to Indonesians and Australians living in Indonesia, warning them of the possibility of bombings in nightclubs, bars, tourist areas, particularly those in places where tourists frequented. No updated travel advisory was issued between October 3rd and October 12th by your government. But you are saying that you're doing everything possible to alert Australians to the danger. You've had Mr. Blix reviewing the issue of travel advisories. Are you still satisfied that you did everything possible to warn Australians intending to go to Indonesia before the Bali bombings of the danger that may be there? Thank you.
Well, I suppose there are two things I'd say about this. First of all, in relation to the somewhat tendentious initial remarks, I would make this observation. Bali is not part of Australia. It's a foreign country and it's in a developing country. And of course in Indonesia, they have limited resources to deal with something like this. And what's more, given the size of the catastrophe, the number of injured and killed, they had no, and this is not surprising, they did not have the capacity to deal with a problem of that dimension. We had emergency services on the way to Bali. The bomb went off Eastern States time, let's think, early on the Sunday morning. It would have been just beyond Saturday, early on the Sunday morning, in the very early hours of Sunday morning. Pretty much by sunrise, not much beyond sunrise, a little beyond sunrise, we had aircraft leaving Richmond with emergency teams on board. Within 48 hours, we got the injured out of Bali to hospitals in Australia, initially to Darwin, but as you know, they went to other parts of Australia in time. I'm defensive of that. I reckon the Air Force, I think the staff in the Air Force and doctors and nurses and so on who assisted with that, I think they did a wonderful job. And I am defensive of that.
Sorry, but what about the dead?
And I'm proud of them. I'm really proud of them.
But what about the
secondly,
dead?
Secondly, for the dead.
Who were left in the sun for 7 days.
Well, we got the injured out within 48 hours. I think getting them out of a foreign country, thousands of kilometres, particularly from where we have those particular assets, that was an extraordinary job. We have, of course, a tiny consulate team in Denpasar, but people were flown in from Jakarta and from other places rather quickly. Yes, there were problems. Of course there were problems. And I think the biggest single problem that stands out has been the question of the repatriation of the remains. But, of course, at the end of the day, compassionate as I feel for those who wanted the remains of their loved ones repatriated immediately, I can, of course, understand the other side of the argument, which was that there had to be positive and appropriate identification. I really can understand that side of the argument as well. If we didn't have positive identification, then I don't think... you would have ended up with possibly a quite horrific situation where misidentification led to, in time, reclassification and, you know, remains being interred and so on, and it's really a horrible thought, all of that. That's why in these situations that often can take a fair bit of time. On the issue of the travel advisories, well, as you rightly say, we've referred all the intel. You can imagine Australia gets a good deal of intelligence material. The ministers and prime minister can't. I mean, it's just impossible to read it all. It's processed in departments through agencies and so on. And selections of this material are passed from time to time to the prime minister and other relevant ministers, not to all ministers. In the material that was passed to us and that has been reinvestigated by the Office of National Assessment, by ASIO and the Australian Secret Intelligence Service, we've not been advised of any forewarnings that were available of the Bali bombing, nor have the Americans or the British, with whom it's no secret we have some intelligence sharing arrangements, dug up any material which gave forewarning of those bombings. So, nevertheless, just to be absolutely sure of this and to satisfy the community, we've asked the Inspector General of Intelligence to investigate all of the material. It's going to take him a few weeks because there's so much material, and we'll just have to wait and see what happens with his report. But certainly we have no knowledge of any such material, and nor do the Americans and the British and the Indonesians, to the best of our knowledge, and we're quite some weeks further down the track now, have knowledge of that material. I don't have the details of all the travel advisories with me here today, but I would make this point to you that we put out three types of travel advisories, so did the Americans. Let's compare us with the Americans. The British do the same. And it was alleged in the period, unfortunately I was in Bali and then in Jakarta setting up the joint investigation, which I spoke of earlier, and so I wasn't here to deal with the problem, with the issue, but it was alleged that we had different travel advisories from the Americans. We're different countries, we certainly use different words, and the American travel advisory was more upgraded than ours. But when I got back to Australia, I sat down and had a look at all of the material. And, I mean, I would have been deeply disturbed if that was the case and that we had, my department had performed inadequately. But on reviewing the material, I can see there's been some confusion between embassy bulletins and country advisories and worldwide advisories. When I looked at all three categories and compared the Americans with the Australian ones, I was satisfied, including in ours, references to the dangers of bars and clubs and so on, as was in the American material, that on the basis, of course, not on the basis of what happened, but on the basis of the knowledge that the departments had available to them, that the travel advisory was adequate. And it wasn't adequate, of course, for what happened, but it was adequate on the basis of the information that I'm aware they had available to them.
Thank you. And just in conclusion, in your heart, politician aside, as an individual, as a person, when you sleep or before you go to sleep, do you actually ever think that anything you've said or done as Foreign Minister or the Prime Minister since September 11th...
Has what? Sorry?
That nothing you've said or done in terms of your foreign policy since September 11th contributed in any way to Bali and that Australians weren't the targets of those bombs? Like, do you really believe that
I read your column about that. Am I personally responsible for the death of 87, 6 or 7 Australians in Bali, and do I go to bed at night worrying about that? Did I kill them? No. Actually, could I put it to you this way? I think the people who committed that barbaric act of murder are the people who are responsible for it. And I don't think Mr. Howard or I or Mr. Crane or Mr. Beasley or whoever it may be have a bloodthirsty vein in their bodies. And I think, there's a difference between you and somebody who's grieving for his lost son. You know, I can really understand that. My heart goes out to people like that. But I think if, you know, you're a commentator and you know, you sort of imply that I have the blood of 86 people on my hands, that is to imply that, you know, I had some view that would be desirable. And I think that's shocking. That's just shocking. I reckon the Canberra Press Gallery can be bad, but these guys are amazing.
I've got two lined up. Can we take two quick ones, Rex? Two quick ones.
Pressure on us, always be quick. John Murch from Radio Adelaide. Mr. Downer, my question is relating to someone you may not have spoken about for a while, or you might have spoken about yesterday, leading up to Christmas, and I guess it's adding a little bit to your feelings here. David Hicks is still in Cuba. How are the diplomatic talks going on that issue at the moment, and do you think there'll be a resolution by next year? If not, why not?
Well, I don't know when there'll be, as you put it, a resolution. The fact is that David Hicks was detained in Afghanistan participating in with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in a war against the coalition forces. He was a combatant in that environment, and then for as long as the combat continues, there won't be an enthusiasm to just brush the concern aside. I think it's a matter of great concern to me, and I think not to all, but to most Australians, that some Australians would become combatants with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Al-Qaeda, I think, is the most horrific terrorist organisation the world has ever known. And my advice to people is not to get involved with Al-Qaeda. That's my advice, and that, for me, is the big issue.
And finally on that, so you believe that he is guilty of actually joining the group?
Well, he was a combatant. And he admits it. He isn't denied that.
Mr. Downer, Nan Taxton, ABC Radio Current Affairs. Given Australia's recent history with East Timor, how much of a concern is it the instability in that country at the moment?
Well, I am concerned about the events of the last couple of days. I've been taken aback by them because, as I said yesterday, I was in East Timor just last week, on Wednesday of last week, and all seemed very calm and quiet there at that time. Indeed, I remember commenting to the Prime Minister of East Timor how calm it seemed as compared to the previous occasions I'd been there, and he agreed. And so this particular event was disturbing because of the way the violence erupted. We think because the East Timor police went into the university to arrest a student who was to be charged with murder, and there was a violent scuffle that broke out, which sort of escalated and escalated and escalated into substantial demonstrations and quite a horrific problem. And it's now somewhat under control, I believe. Hopefully there won't be a repeat of that. But what concerns me is the way this sort of violence can erupt so quickly, and I hope not to see any more of it. And I'm glad that the Prime Minister of East Timor, Mari Alkatiri, has called for an inquiry.
So no need for Australia to resume any sort of active service there at this stage?
Sorry?
no need for Australian troops to return to East Timor at this stage?
Well, there are Australian troops in East Timor, and there are some in Dili, but the bulk of the Australian troops, the Australian Battalion, AusBat as it's known, is out in the western part of East Timor, and the Dili area is the responsibility of the Portuguese soldiers, and I understand they did Portuguese soldiers did contribute to stabilising the situation.
Last question.
Minister, we haven't met personally before, but I think you know who I am, Brian Deegan. I want to let you put your mind at ease. I'm not going to attack you. I'm not going to argue with you. I don't feel like doing that. Not now, not in the future. I felt that I had to ask you a couple of questions, and I don't want to be patronised like I have been in the past. I am a grieving parent, there is no doubt about that. But 25% of me is grieving like I've never known before. 75% of me is worried like I've never been worried before. I have three children, but I correct you on this point. I only have one daughter. And as you did mention, they do go to school together with your daughter. I'd rather wish you had never mentioned that, but when you brought it out, I must correct things. In fact, so much so that you may not also know this. The very first party my daughter attended at the new school that we sent her to this year was at your home. I didn't attend, but my wife did. So I feel that although we have never met personally, I do know a bit about you. And again, I repeat, I'm not going to attack you. I have one question immediately. When is the report into what occurred before the 12th of October? When will it be prepared and when will it be distributed? Secondly, we talk here about people, but no faces. I go to sleep every night seeing a face, and I don't sleep. I think before arguments continue, the people that argue for or against what the government is doing had better get a couple of pictures in their mind. And that is what I go through each night. This isn't clean. It is a filthy exercise. I had an elder son who was my alter ego. He was an academic and he was a sportsman. His body was torn apart. Now, I think people, before they talk about wars, should realise that's what happens to young children. I want to know also if any investigations have been carried out by your department as to what has occurred since Bali. And I'm going to tell you what has occurred to my family, and I would ask that you investigate your own department. I was told once my son was dead, and then I was told he was missing. And then my 11-year-old and I were confronted by armed police to tell me my son was dead. And that was 3 weeks later. And that I'm not happy about. I begged your department to stop ringing me because they continued to ring me each night telling me what we had to go through to get my son back. I informed them that I was a deputy coroner and I well knew what had to occur. I asked one lady one question. Will my son be returning in 3 or 4 days or 3 or 4 weeks? Just answer me that and I'll live with it and I'll help my family through. Her answer to me was, all I can say, it will be 3 or 4 days or 3 or 4 weeks. And I said that was my question. Since then, I received a letter from your department advising me that your department was to help my family. They had imposed a case manager, and no longer would I have to deal with many departments and get nowhere. That letter was received 4 weeks ago, and I haven't heard from you since. The only bit of assistance that I have received from your department was a question of whether or not I would like somebody to come and cut my lawns. Now, what is being done to make certain that when all of this travesty occurs again, and it will, that this government will look after not just the dead, but the living? Because we are only just barely living.
Mr. Deegan, I'll have to ask you to...
I have nothing more to add. And I don't expect you to answer all my questions at this stage. You can take them on notice if you wish.
Well, I don't walk away from the simple point. However, people respond to it, that as a parent of four children myself, I can, you know, I can only express my profound sympathy to you. I just can understand what a simply shocking situation it must be for you and your family, and for me as the minister, in the case of all of the families, there's never been on my part, but, you know, forgetting me, leaving me out of all of this, on those officers in my department, there's never been a scintilla of ill will that I've discovered there. I think those people have cared and been upset, and some have been very emotional. Many officers in my department have broken down in tears. It's been a very emotional and difficult thing for them. And, you know, that I don't feel for them in the way I feel for you and those, many of you, unfortunately, not just you, but many of you who have found yourselves in that sort of situation. I find that, you know, I find it very heart-rending, and it's a terrible, terrible thing. And for me, it's a ghastly statement about how appalling terrorism is. What sort of people would ever descend to that sort of behaviour? I just find that within humanity there are people who could sink so low is just incomprehensible to me. It's just such a terrible tragedy. Obviously, I mean, I'm not aware of who has made phone calls to whom and how and when and why, and I'm just not familiar with any of that material. I'll ask my department to give me some information on the contacts that they've had with you and where they've, you know, what you've said. We'll check that and see why that's happened. But I just want to make the point to you that I guess I'm not perfect, and the people in my department aren't perfect. No one in this room is perfect. I don't always judge people by the perfection of their performance. I often judge them by the perfection of their motives, and I think that the people in my department have to, you know, I will defend them. There are some very good and decent people there, and they haven't wanted to cause any hurt. They haven't wanted to cause any harm. They haven't wanted to cause any distress. They just wanted to help. And if they've failed, I'm sorry they've failed, but their hearts have been in doing the right thing. They've tried. They may have not been adequate, but they've certainly tried as hard as they can. And obviously, coming out of Bali, we'll and are looking at ways we can improve all sorts of things. Dissemination of our travel advisories, I think have been inadequate. My anecdotal evidence is that people don't widely, or didn't before Bali, widely read the travel advisories. I think we have to find better ways of disseminating them. We've got some ideas that we're about to bring forward to the Cabinet on that. We are always looking at ways we can improve our consular assistance to people who get into difficulties in distress or where Australians are killed. We try, but where there have been failures, we look to see if we can ensure that the same thing doesn't happen again. And finally, as far as the Blitz report is concerned, I don't know the answer to your question. I think it's just the important... He hasn't been set a time to do it in. He's just been set the task of doing it. There is an enormous amount of material to go through. I suppose we could cut him off and say must finish it by the end of next week if we're to do that. He may, of course, not have time to go through all the material. But he's working his way through it, and obviously it doesn't report to me, it reports to the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister will deal with it when he gets to him.
Thank you. Thank you, Minister. Anyone here who thinks that the media is in the pockets of politicians or politicians are in the pockets of media have probably got a different thought now. Anyone who thinks also that a minister's job at question time in Parliament is easy probably realised from what's happened this afternoon that it can be very difficult. I would like to thank, on behalf of you all, Minister Downer, for his contribution today. It's been most enlightening. I apologise that we've gone over time, but I think you'll all understand that this was an exceptional circumstance. Thank you all for attending. Thank you, Minister, for your contribution. I have a small gift, Minister, from... Minister, I have a small gift from... it's not from a Hills winery, but the very small print on the bottom of the St. Hugo label says it must be drunk in the hills. So please put it to good use. Thank you very much indeed.
Very, very quickly, I'd just like to draw the raffle. Grant Heading, News Director, Network 10, come on up here and draw the raffle for us. Grant Heading, ladies and gentlemen. The man who has responsibility for Network 10 News. How's the news going, Grant? How are we rating here?
Think you might have got a story today.
What have we got here? Okay, from Telstra, the audio line cordless phone with digital answering system and call display. Who is it?
God, I haven't got my glasses. C, is that 81?
81, green.
Green C81. Is that me, Kieran? There we are.
Green C81. Who's got it? Up the back?
Lady in red.
Lady in red. Okay, for the voucher from Walter Rogers for the Rock Lobster Cafe, $50 the seafood voucher. Walter's here with the voucher. Over there.
We have C76, the purple. Michael Sakel. Come down and receive your prize.
Yes.
Yes.
Now from Ragone's, the $50 voucher from Walter Rogers.
Another green ticket, C80. Bet Porridge. Oh, the ladies are doing well.
The ladies are doing well. And we have two cartons of beer, so we probably need a guy to win these. They're a bit heavy to carry. SA Brewing Southwark Premium.
Black. A76, Anthony Keane.
There he is. And Grant, the last one is the Hahn Light from SA Brewing.
The last one was a black one, A76. And this one is red, C4, C Ratcliffe. Don't you like beer?
Thank you, Grant. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, thank Grant Heading from Channel 10. Thanks, Grant. Thank you, everyone, for your attendance today. Have a safe Christmas, and we do hope to see you at a press club luncheon in 2003. Thank you very much.